Hey, welcome to the 15th episode of Write You a Song. I'm Tom Maley, and I appreciate everybody who takes the time to stream or download this podcast, and I guarantee the songwriters we talk to appreciate it, too. If you're new to Write You a Song, we've got 14 other excellent interviews in the archives with songwriters like Tim Nichols, Liz Rose, Jeffrey Steele, Ashley McBride, Josh Osborne, a bunch of others, and every single one of them is fun to listen to. You realize real quick, doing this podcast, the songwriters are an entertaining, expressive bunch. Maybe that's why they're songwriters. And none of them have been hesitant to share stories or advice or their individual approaches to their craft. If you like this podcast, I'd love it if you took a moment to rate it and share it with your friends, too. As for this month's guest, I can't even believe he's agreed to come on the show. He's one of the busiest people in not just Nashville, but music in general. He's a producer, a publisher, a mentor, and a coach on the breakout NBC songwriting show Songland. And since 2010, he's written or co-written over 40 number one songs. Not 40 songs that made it onto the charts, over 40 that topped the charts. That's almost unthinkable. Here's a few of them.
Small town, innocent but still a little wild child. Girl, that night was just like you, unforgettable.
Hey, he's gifted, yeah, but he's also worked his butt off to get where he is, and he is still grinding. So it's really cool he took time to do this. Shane McAnally, thank you for joining us today on Write You a Song.
Thank you for having me. I'm real excited. I mean, something called Write You a Song seems like it should be easy for me to do. That's what I do.
You know, I was thinking about it, and you ever watch those cooking shows, and they show the ingredients that go into this dish or that, you know, whatever?
Yes, I watch them all the time, actually. I love the kids' cooking show, actually. That sounds kind of funny, but that's about as good as I could cook, but not near as good as those kids can cook, and I like watching it with my kids.
But what always blows my mind with those shows is that there are, like, certain key ingredients that are common denominators with, like, everything. For example, brown sugar. Until I started watching these shows, I was like, I didn't realize how much brown sugar made the food universe go around. And
right. To
me, you are that to Nashville songwriting community. You are the brown sugar to country.
Oh, I like it. I mean, I would probably call myself the ginger. I really appreciate that. That sounds, I take that as a huge compliment for sure.
It's meant to be. I mean, seriously, you look at, you know, song credits over the last several years and your name is there again and again and again. And not just in a songwriting capacity, in a producing capacity, in a publishing capacity. It's just, it's amazing how kind of omnipresent you are. And like brown sugar, you make everything better.
Oh, wow. Gosh, well, thanks. You need to tell my husband that. Thank you.
You have said several times that you felt kind of preordained to be a songwriter because you've been writing songs as far back as you can remember.
Correct. Yeah, you know, I just always did it. I just had this conversation with someone because I was talking about my own kids and trying to make sure that they find whatever it is they're great at, because I was lucky enough to have a few just destined moments that sort of turned me towards music, but it wasn't something that was natural to anybody else in my family. No one said, oh, play guitar, or oh, play piano, or you should write songs. I just did it, and I had never seen anyone else do it, so it was clearly meant to be. I did find out something really interesting very recently, and I've never even talked about this, so you're getting some super inside scoop. My dad was adopted, and I did know that growing up. And I grew up with who would, I guess, be my adopted grandfather. He was my grandfather, and he was McAnally. And we very recently found out about my dad's biological father. And my dad didn't know him, and I had never met him, of course. And we even got some pictures of him as a teenager, and he is holding a guitar at every one of them.
Wow.
And that just kind of blew my mind, because I had never seen anyone in my family who was interested in music like that. So it just shows how sort of there is a nature part of it. It was just in my blood, and it just showed up, you know.
It is in the DNA.
Right.
I loved how you were talking about when you were a kid, because I used to do this too. My dad had a big record collection. Then I had older brothers and sisters who also had record collections. And this is back when an album was an album. And it wasn't just about listening. It was about the whole experience of opening the album up, and were there going to be pictures inside, and were there liner notes. And you were that kid who did that. In some cases, it was better than the record that you were listening to at the time.
I remember more about it a lot of times than I do the music. Mm-hmm. Now, the grandfather who was my grandfather that I knew, that was Buddy McAnally, who, like I said, wasn't my biological grandfather, but who I knew as my grandfather, he had a huge record collection. And I would spend, from a very young age, I would just spend hours in that music room. Now, I couldn't work the record player. I didn't know how to do all that stuff. But they would let me just sit in there and look at it like I was looking at a coloring book. Mm-hmm. And I would just look at those covers. In fact, I was at Martin's Barbecue recently here in Nashville. And I looked up and I saw the cover of the Conway Twitty record, Mr. T. And he's like standing. So the album covers then were so intricate. He's like on a golf course by a Cadillac. And anyway, I had forgotten about that album cover, and I mean, it just took me right back to the carpet, to the way the room smelled, mm-hmm. to the window, to just looking at that album cover. And gosh, I get chills talking about it. I'm actually in my office as I'm talking to you right now, and I'm looking at the cover of the Midland album mm-hmm. that, you know, they do press some records now, and seeing my name on the back of it as produced by Dan Huff, Shane McAnally, and Josh Osborne. And I'm looking at it as I talk to you, because one of the things that really resonated with me as a kid is I would see the same names over and over in the produced by column. And one name I saw over and over was Tom Collins, and he produced Barbara Mandrell and Ronnie Millsap, among others. But those two people specifically, I would notice over and over seeing Tom Collins' name. And ultimately, when I got to meet Tom Collins years later in Nashville, that was just such a huge deal to me, because I had made fake records where I would draw my name as an artist and then I would put produced by Tom Collins.
Wow.
Because I thought that meant, you know, you must have made it. So anyway, yeah, the album art itself is a big part of it.
I listened to your one and only album from 2000 yesterday as I was getting ready for this. That whole album, Shane, is really good. I mean, for that time period, you were in the sweet spot for what country music was at that time. And I'm listening to it like I was waiting for some song to kind of just be a clunker. But they were, to me, they were all like they would have been hits. It's always been a mystery to me why one artist makes it, another one doesn't. And I don't understand why. And I'm listening to this album yesterday. I'm like, why the hell didn't he take off back then? Could you just talk a little bit about that? And I'm sure it had to piss you off at the time.
It did. Actually, yeah, it's a perfect way to say it. It hurt me. It pissed me off. I worked really hard and a really long time on it. And, you know, there's a lot, it just sounds so cliche, but there's just a lot to do with timing. I was on Curb Records. At the time, Curb had the biggest roster in Nashville with Tim McGraw, Wynonna, Leanne Rimes, Jody Messina. And they were all just red hot. And it just seemed like such a sure bet. And, you know, I went on a rigorous radio tour for almost 2 years. I was on tour with Alabama, who at the time was playing, you know, for 15,000 people. I had the biggest manager in town. It just seemed like everything was done right. And for me personally, I had to kind of spiritually get past my entitlement as to why it didn't work out. And I think it was because I was on a journey of self-exploration, and also I was in the closet. And ultimately, I don't know what would have happened to me personally if that had worked out, because I wanted it so bad, but I wanted it on my terms, mm-hmm. and I wanted to keep my sexuality a secret. And that never would have worked. If those songs had become hits and I had become a celebrity at that point in my life, not to sound dramatic, but I'm not sure I would have survived, because what followed was a pretty heavy alcohol and drug problem. And, you know, I think that all was from the fear of people finding out that I was gay. And I just don't think that a career in country music at that moment would have lined up for me. I don't think it would have mattered what the song was or what I had. I think it was about my own journey. It had nothing to do with the record label or with radio. I was mad at all of them for a really long time.
Well, and your fears weren't unfounded because you had Shelley Wright, you had Ty Herndon.
Well, I was watching what was happening to Ty Herndon, and, you know, it was right in the middle of that. And so that, of course, pushed me further into the closet. And, it just wasn't my time. And I really wouldn't trade it. I can't believe I say that now, mean it from the bottom of my heart. I think a lot of times we say, I wouldn't change a second of it. I got hurt so many times and was so down for so long, but I know how it showed back up in my work. And I also know now that the relationships I have with artists through my record label, through my publishing company, through the show Songland, I can truly say I have been there. And I think that helps a lot. And it's not just somebody on the other side of a desk telling you why it might not work. It's somebody who says, look, I know how hard this is. I know how it hurt. I know how you believe in it. But having been there and having gone through it, these are some things that are going to have to change. And the number one thing that it always comes back to is authenticity. People read that. It doesn't matter. You know, we think that that's just a nice part of the story. They were being themselves. But in order to break through on a bigger stage, to truly have a career, people recognize when you're not being real. And, you know, sometimes there's even people that play characters. When you think of pop stars like Lady Gaga or Madonna, yeah, those people are playing characters. But at the root of all of it, you see who they are. And you also realize they're playing characters. What I was trying to do was be someone else. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people can relate to that.
So you don't think you could have had the success that you've enjoyed had you not reconciled with yourself and been completely honest and just, you know, went with who you are?
Well, I couldn't have written the songs I have. I mean, that's when everything changed for me, when I finally was able to come out and sort of just let go, because I just held on so tight for so long to the secret. I just didn't have any more strength for it. That was when I started having success as a songwriter, because I stopped worrying about the pronouns in co-writing sessions. I stopped going in and trying to tell a story about a female that wasn't really true. You know, it's just, again, even in co-writes, people knew I was gay. They just didn't want to acknowledge it because I wasn't acknowledging it. Mm-hmm. And so it puts everyone in this state of like putting on a story. And when I shifted that story and surrounded myself with people who just did not care, we started writing the truth. And then the truth resonates. It doesn't matter if I was writing about a man. It doesn't matter if I'd been writing about a woman. Mm-hmm. It was the truth. And, you know, at the end of the day, love songs about either pronoun are the same. We hurt the same. We love the same. We heal the same. But it has to come from a place of truth.
And you've unshackled the real you. You've basically freed the real you to express what's really inside of you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now I was going to kind of go down the road of, you know, you spent 7 years in L.A. and we might touch on that.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about right now is, I think this is a good point to bring this up. I've interviewed, I think, 14 other songwriters on this show, and several of them have referenced you. Several have worked directly with you. But to a person, they talk about what a unifying person you are. Here's what Brandi Clark said.
He's so good at not only seeing talent in others, but in believing and never stopping his belief. It wouldn't matter if God came down from heaven and said, you know, Shane, Brandi Clark's just not very good. He would say, you're wrong.
Well, that makes me tear up a little, because I do think that's not something you choose, meaning that I get a lot of credit for that, especially from Brandi, about standing up for an artist or a song that I love. I was given some sort of, I'm scared in most situations. I have had to walk through more fear than just about anybody. But when it comes to knowing something in my gut, I know it. And it's like, if I hear someone sing or I hear a song that I know is right, no one can tell me any different. not 20 people. I don't care how many times over someone says, this just isn't it. I'll just say, I know you're wrong. And it doesn't mean it has to be for everybody, but I know it's for somebody. And that's just a gift of, I don't know what that is called, but I do believe it is one of, it was something I was born with. And, you know, sometimes I guess it could probably work against me because, like I said earlier, I mean, I'll go down in flames for it. Like everybody around me saying this isn't going to work. I mean, I've been working with an artist named Walker Hayes for years. He doesn't fit the radio. Mm-hmm. I don't know what genre he fits. I just know how I feel when I hear his songs. But people want to put everyone in a box and they don't want to do things that are hard. And I get it. I'd love for it to be easy. I would love so much for someone just to go, Walker Hayes is a superstar. I hear it through and through. It hasn't been that way in trying to break him, but it hasn't changed the way I feel about him.
She always said if something ever happened to me, she would never fall in love again. What a waste. We always said we'd go together, but if I'm just half of her forever, this goes out to whoever takes my place. She don't give two cents about money. Nice little coffee and her honey. Let her sleep late as she wants. Home is her favorite restaurant. Don't you dare come home if you hammer. Better watch your mouth and your grammar. She loves babies, hates glitter. You better shave before you kiss her. And if she ever misses me, please don't let her.
And it's the same with Brandi Clarke. And Brandi does not fit the standards of what a superstar is. You know, I'm putting quotes around that. She's not as young as they would like their superstars to be. She also writes and tells her stories pretty specifically on acoustic guitar. And she says a lot of things in her songs that are not for the masses.
You don't need a needle. Ever lose a lover or want to lose some weight, which you can't cure, you medicate if one won't work, then another one will. If you got a little hurt, you take a little pill, lay it on your tongue.
But I do know that when I hear her sing with her guitar, something happens in me that I could never deny it. It wouldn't matter what someone said about her. I would say, I just know what I feel, and I know other people will feel that too. And I'm proud that she sees that in me, and I also know it to be true.
Well, you can also say the same thing about Kacey Musgraves. She's maybe more well-known than Brandi is or Walker Hayes, but she's another one that you can't put in a box.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the thing about Kacey is she looked the part so much that it took years for people to understand that just because you look like what people think the next big thing is supposed to look like does not mean you're going to make the music that sounds like that. I think everyone, myself included, had an idea of who she could be because she's just American, like, royalty. I mean, she just looks like the face of country music. Mm-hmm. She looks right with a guitar. She can really play it. She can really sing. She sounds like Dolly Parton. She's everything we want. But what put people off or confused people was that she wasn't willing to sing songs that weren't completely true to her. And her story was not that everything was I don't even know what to say about it. Like, you know, a lot of people would always pitch me songs for Kacey and they would have to have like weed references in them or D-I-V-O-R-C-E references or things like that. And the truth is, I understand on paper why you think that. She's a country girl from Texas. She speaks her mind. But the thing is, those songs, that just because she has a weed reference in a song doesn't mean that that's her entire story. And she hadn't been divorced. And so, I mean, she ultimately has sang songs about those topics, but my point is she has to feel it and honestly has missed out on some big hits because of it. I mean, on the first record, there were a couple of songs that we wrote early on that were just absolute surefire smashes down the middle that would have worked on the radio, and she knew it and her label knew it. But she said to me, I know that song's a hit, but I cannot sing it for the rest of my life. It does not suit me. And it's not something I want to go on stage every night and be part of my story. And it pissed me off at the time because I'm like, oh my God, you have this song just sitting there like, it will take you to the top. Ultimately, what she was building is her entire story. Now she gets to go out on stage in front of all those people, but only sing songs that do tell her story. And she doesn't have to sing that song that I'm talking about that I still wish she would sing. And, you know, I just respect that so much. She knew herself so well. I still have never met anyone who knew themselves at that age. You know, I'm talking about when I met her at like 22. I just couldn't believe how settled into her skin she was. She knew what she would and wouldn't do, and she's never compromised.
She understood the power of no early, and it takes some people their whole lives to figure that out. Wow.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I feel like I learned it through her. I mean, I feel like I was like, oh my God, if I had known that at 22, when I was making that record over a curve, if I had known what she knows, that would have had a different journey, you know? She wasn't even born then.
See, and I think that speaks to your amazing versatility, which is probably also why so many people relate to you and love working with you, and you are kind of a cohesive factor in the Nashville songwriting community because you can see the worth of a Walker Hayes or a Brandi Clark or a Kacey Musgraves, and you can see their value and their integrity, and you can also see, because they're not necessarily commercially successful or how we define success these days, and yet you can turn around and you can work with somebody who's over the top commercially successful, and you can help them become even better too. It's amazing how you're able to switch hats so quickly and seemingly effortlessly. Is it that effortless?
Well, yeah, because you know, you really can't ever know what the masses are going to take to, because a lot of times it's not for the reason you would think, or, you know, I just, in my mind, Kacey Musgraves, she checks every box in a way that I would think she was the biggest star in all of music. And she's not. She's in her lane, in her world. She's exactly where she's supposed to be. And she shines so bright, and she brings so many people to our format and beyond. But, you know, there are people that are much bigger stars for whatever reason. And maybe it's because they're more middle. Maybe it's because their story resonates with more people. I don't know what it is. But when you say that it's easy to switch hats, it's more about just writing the song with them that really cuts to the heart of what they want to say. The one thing, the thread between all of those artists for me is that when I get in a room, we're not trying to write a hit. We're just saying, hey, what's floating in the room today? What's going on in your world? What can we write about? You know, over and over, I hear these people tell these stories of like, well, such and such is looking for a hit. I tried that. It never once worked for me. Hmm. I have to write what is going on in either my world or the person sitting across from me's world and get in there. And then that has turned into a lot of hits. But I tried the other way. And I'm a little bit jealous sometimes of people that can go, I'm going to paint by numbers today and I'm going to write a smash for Luke Bryan. I just never have been able to do that.
When you were in L.A., is that where you met J.T. Harding? Because he was in L.A. too, and you guys went on.
No, we did not know each other in L.A., which is so crazy. We actually met in Nashville, and our stories were just so similar in that we were at the end of the end of the end of the rope, both sides of us. I mean, like, we had a mutual friend that I had known from Nashville years before, and he had known as well, and we were all three set up to write. Now, I had never met J.T., but the three of us were supposed to get together. And the third party canceled. Now, normally, because he was the person who tied us all together, the right just wouldn't have happened. But JT and I didn't have a lot of options. And so we got on the phone and we're like, well, he can't do it. He still just want to get together. And we got together and we told each other what was going on in our lives. I had just lost my house in L.A. and I had just gone through a terrible breakup. And he told me that when he left the right that day, he was going to pack up his apartment over off 16th because the building was being torn down. And this is all true. And that was the day we wrote Somewhere With You. and all of the things that had to line up for that to happen and what it set in motion for both of us, it just kind of showed, you know, that was both of our first number one. Kenny Chesney 4 week number one, and we just showed up.
If you're going out someone new, I'm going out someone too. I won't feel sorry for me. I'm getting drunk, but I'd much rather be somewhere with you, laughing loud on a carnival ride, driving around Saturday night and made fun of me, singing my song, got a hotel room just to turn you on. Said pick me up at 3 a.m. You're fighting with your mom again, and I'd go, I'd go, I'd go somewhere with you.
And that's a lot of times what I tell people is the biggest secret is I just kept showing up. And there was no reason that day for me to go. He didn't have success. I didn't have success. Nothing was going on. The guy who was supposed to write with us, who was actually the hit writer, canceled. And then the two of us got together and wrote this big hit. So, you know, it's just you just show up.
Well, and I guess that answers a question I wanted to ask. You struggled, and so many songwriters have the same story. I mean, what kept you going? What?
I don't know. I mean, because I had nothing else. I mean, I was working at a restaurant at that point when I moved back from L.A. I moved to Nashville. I had nothing. I lived on my little sister's couch. She's 8 years younger than me. She owned her own house. I slept on her couch. I borrowed her boyfriend's car, and I got a job at the restaurant she was working at. At that point, I was 33, and I had Last Call by Leanne Womack recorded, which is what brought me back to Nashville from L.A.
Baby, I still love you. Don't mean nothing when there's whiskey on your breath. That's the only love I get. So if you're calling, I bet you're in a bar listening to a cheating song. Glass of Johnny Walker Red with no one to take you home. They're probably closing down, saying no more alcohol. I bet you're in a bar, 'cause I'm always your last call.
And it hadn't come out or anything. And I would ride with her sometimes to work, or sometimes, like I said, I would borrow her boyfriend's car. And one night in the kitchen at the restaurant out in Hendersonville, Last Call came on the radio in the kitchen. And I was just taking food out to people. And I wouldn't even tell the cooks or any of the people back there that it was my song.
Baby, I won't be there to catch you when you fall. I bet you're
I didn't think they'd believe me. And honestly, I was just embarrassed. It was just like, how did I end up here? I had moved to Nashville at that point 14 years earlier. And I had had failed record deals, failed publishing deals. And I just didn't want any attention on the fact that I had this song on the radio and I was working at this restaurant. But it is something I also use with young writers. When there is a sense of entitlement that happens when something happens for you, when you get a publishing deal, no matter how long you've worked for it, somehow this air of, well, I've made it, comes along. And that's not usually the case. There's a whole lot more involved than getting a record deal or a publishing deal. And over when I'm working with a writer who's like, well, I've had a publishing deal for 5 years, I can barely make ends meet, I haven't had a hit, I say, go get another job. Go get a job at a restaurant. Go get a job at a coffee shop. Go get a job that you think you're above and do it as good as you can do it. And I've heard this advice before. And actually, Josh Osborne told me that I told him that. I don't remember that. But he lost his publishing deal about 8 years ago before he'd had any hits. And he was telling me, like, look, he's married. He's been doing this at that point for over a decade. And he said, I still know what I'm going to do. Nobody wants to sign me. And I said, Go to Starbucks and just work there and just see what happens. And he did it, which most of the time people don't actually do it. He went, he got an application, he filled it out, he was starting the next day, and he got a publishing deal. And that really did happen. And it's just showing the universe, showing God, whatever you believe, that you're available. It's like, show up and the other doors will open. But sometimes staring at that door will keep it from opening.
While you were going through this, were you ever looking at the clock? Were you ever glancing apprehensively at the calendar?
All the time. I was comparing myself to everybody in their age. Because I just thought, how am I going to catch up? I wanted to have a family. I wanted to have kids. I wanted to be able to support these people. I wanted to be able to support myself. You know, a decade ago, just 10 years ago, my tax return for that year was $12,000. And in a decade, I've had 41 number ones. I mean, it's all, I guess, retroactive or something. But I was, until that started to happen, and even then, I mean, in the middle of my big run through my late 30s, I was still felt like I was so far behind everyone else at my age. But it just had to happen the way it happened. And I do not compare my age anymore to people. I'm 45. I keep saying 44, but I turned 45 last week. And, you know, I guess in my mind, I just think I'm halfway to 90. So I've got another 40 plus number ones to write.
Is the fire still as bright?
No, it's a different kind of fire. It's a slow burn, I think, now. I am really trying to ease into some other projects. I think showing up for 10 years and writing a lot of days twice a day, just to feed that fire, that part of it it's simmered a little. Certainly having kids, I want to spend time with them. It's not like that feeling of like, oh, I've done it, but I want to do other things. I'm working on a Broadway musical with Brandi Clark that we've been working on for a few years. That really inspires me because the songs are different. You get to tell the story in a different way, and there really are no rules. And so having written in the country music field for a while, you know, if you want to have hits, there are some rules. But writing for Broadway, there are none. And I've really enjoyed that sort of no fences approach.
Yeah, the musical is it kind of loosely based on the old TV show Hee Haw? Do I have that right?
Well, that's where it started. You know, we initially were writing something loosely based on the old show Hee Haw. As the years have gone on and as the characters have changed, there's less Hee Haw in it and more just hometown. And it's a story. So it's not just, you know, Hee Haw was more of a vaudeville variety type show. This is more of a story. It's just the story of community and finding out that, like so many stories, that home a lot of times is where your heart is. And even if you leave, you have to remember where you came from. And even if you don't end up back there, you take a lot of that with you. And it resonates with me. And I've just enjoyed writing songs for that so much. And I've got a movie project in the very far wings that I'm super excited about, that I'm just getting started on, and it's a musical as well. And the publishing part of this and getting to really mentor, that word always sounds so, I don't know, self-righteous, mentoring people, but it's not to mentor someone to teach them how to write songs. It's to teach them how to write songs smartly, to where they use their time in a way that they're not just spinning their wheels and that they're able to really dig in and tell their truth, because that's the only way they're going to write anything original, is by telling their story. So I've gotten to really sort of use that experience on the show Songland.
And congratulations on Songland being renewed for another season.
Thank you.
It's a fascinating show to watch for anybody who loves music. And we've speculated, are we going to look up like 10, 15 years from now, and the profession of songwriting, will it have changed somewhat because of the influence that your show has had? Because you kind of cut out the middleman and the years of desperation for some of these people. And for others who maybe never make it onto the show, they at least see what the craft is really all about and how hard they have to work. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, I don't know how much it'll change the overall genre of songwriting. It's, you know what I've noticed? It's just like when I came to Nashville, I was 19 years old. I got a publishing deal within 6 months of being here, and I had a record deal within a year. I thought I was going to be fast tracked. I just thought everybody talks about this 10-year town. And I was like, well, you know, maybe it's just different for me. Maybe all the years I put in on the Opry circuit and all of those things have just counted towards this. And yeah, I had a lot of big breaks early on, but it ultimately caught up with me. And those 10,000 hours that people talk about, I certainly put them in before I had any big success. And I think the same is going to go for the people on Songland. I think it's a big moment for them. And I think that some of them are going to see some pretty, big results right away from it, as we've seen already, but they're still going to have to put the time in, and they're still going to show up, and they're still going to have some hard things show up. And I also don't believe it has to be hard. That sounds weird, but I've come to the conclusion that a lot of times things are hard because we believe they have to be. I think that it can be fun and educational, and that you can really just roll with it. I wish I had enjoyed it more. So instead of saying there's going to be hard times, I should just say there's going to be time, and it is going to take what it takes. I don't think that being on Songland is going to jump anybody to the head of the line. It may give them a temporary flash, but the time put in is still part of it.
All right. Now, we've got just a few minutes left, and you've been more than gracious with your time. I want to get to a couple of things here real quick. First, I want to ask you just some quick kind of rapid-fire questions. And this is a question that popped into my head yesterday when I was listening to your album. You have one song on there. I think it's called "I Could Have Told You That." And there's a line, "Only he knows what I'm missing," which I thought was a great line. And
yeah.
Do you ever part out songs? Do you ever go back and reach back to a song that maybe never got cut, never got recorded, but there was a great line or two from there that would fit in perfectly with this? Or is it always new all the time?
No, I definitely steal from old songs. I'm more likely to steal from a song that I wrote by myself. That way I don't feel like there's any question of where the line came from. So unless it was 100% something that I know I came up with, mm-hmm. and that I wouldn't feel like the previous co-writers would feel slighted by, I wouldn't take it. Like in that song, I don't know who came up with that line. But I do steal from songs that I've written by myself, because a lot of times they were based on something that didn't work at all as a whole song, but there might be one line that I'm like, man, that was really good. I wish I could have written a better song around it. So the answer is yes.
What's your most personal song? What's a song that recorded by somebody else, you're listening to it, and what you're hearing is like Shane McAnally, your story, who you really are? Is there one?
There is. It happens so often, but it especially happens in the beginning of the sort of run of songs that started to be hits for me. And the one that comes to mind is "Somewhere With You" by Kenny Chesney. I just had gone through a really bad breakup and something that I knew wasn't good for me. And JT Harding was in a similar situation, and we just kind of told each other's truth. And what's funny is it's a vague song, and it sounds like it would work for a lot of different people. But when I hear it, I still feel a little bit like someone's reading my diary.
What is a lyric or even a stanza, a verse that you're really proud of?
Yeah, it's in the song "Vice" by Miranda Lambert. And the lyric is, "If you need me, I'll be where my reputation don't perceive me.
I'll wear a tail like a leather jacket. When the new wears off, I don't even pack it. If you need me, I'll be where my reputation don't perceive me. Maybe I'm addicted to goodbyes. Another fight, another town.
So personal to me, because I think a lot of songwriters feel this way. A lot of times they just want to go somewhere where nobody knows them, which is a cliche idea. It even goes back to like the Cheers theme song, you know, except it's the opposite. In the Cheers theme song, you want to go where everybody knows your name.
Right.
And in this one, it's where you want to go where nobody knows your name. And I think that song, I've talked to so many songwriters who say, I just wish I could just go somewhere and just, I don't know, work at a bed and breakfast and not have to worry about the pressures of the music business. And that line, if you need me, I'll be where my reputation don't precede me. That just tells me I'm going to go somewhere and erase the past.
A songwriter that you just completely look up to, and it could be from any era. It could be now, it could be 50 years ago.
Oh God, there's so many, but I mean, I have to say Merle Haggard, because I do think he was the one who started telling such detail about his personal life that it was almost hard to believe. And he opened the door for the rest of us to do that.
The warden led a prisoner down the hallway to his doom. I stood up to say goodbye like all the rest. And I heard him tell the warden just before he reached my cell, let my guitar playing friend do my request. Let him sing me back home with a song I used to hear, and make my old memories come alive.
All right, and I just want to name three or four songs real quick and just kind of get the Cliff Notes story behind the song. And these are just some of my favorites of yours that you've written or co-written. Smoking and Drinking.
Yes. So that was with Natalie Hemby and Luke Laird. And Luke and Natalie just have such an easy vibe. Luke had this amazing track. And Natalie was just singing, smoking and drinking on the weekend. To me, that was all you needed. When I heard her sing that, I was like, I don't really care what goes around that. It gives me, it's like I want to put my hands in the air, but I also want to cry. That's my favorite feeling, because if I'm dancing, but I'm also crying, and that's what that song does.
It was one of those girls and one of those guys who didn't know quite what to do. We were going along with what was going on, saying, I think I love you. And I think about us now, every time that I go out, smoking and drinking. Smoking and drinking on the weekend, like we did back in the day. Smoking and drinking, get you thinking about the one that got away. Yes, to all those nights, all we felt was light. Smoking and drinking.
Young and Crazy.
Young and Crazy. I wrote that with Red Akins and with Ashley Gourley. And I remember the title came from, we did not have a title. And Red Akins read that line on Twitter. And it was like, you know, something about, how am I ever going to be old and wise if I never get to be young and crazy?
Yeah.
And sometimes what I call a bumper sticker line like that is really hard to write in an authentic way. Because it's like, you can tell you started with that line. But with those guys getting in a room with cards, I mean, it's kind of hard to believe. Honestly, if we couldn't have turned that into a hit, I should have just moved away.
One day, I'll slow and way down. Spend my weekends in a swing out on the wraparound. Oh, but these days, I'm on a mission to get these wild oats out of my system. Yeah, I might stay out all night. I gotta do.
Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye.
That was on a road trip. Really funny story, actually, because I got on the bus with Luke Bryan and his producer, Jeff Stevens, and I was terrified. I did not know Luke, and he was just coming off some really big hits. And I had a few ideas that I threw out the first day, and they all fell completely flat. Nothing worked. I played a little chorus I had come up with. I threw out some hooks. Luke just was not into any of them. And thank God Jeff Stevens had the title Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye and that guitar riff. And Luke was like, I like that. And then we just went. And when we had the love me like you love me when you love me and you didn't have to try, when we had that, it was like, okay, we have it. And I left there feeling semi-confident. But then I ran into Luke at the ACM Awards probably 6 months later. And it was actually in the bathroom. Hey, we just cut the shit out of that song. It's going to be a big hit. And I was like, I could barely remember the title, and I was so nervous and so excited, and I couldn't remember if I'd already washed my hands, so I didn't want to shake his hand. So I think I high-fived it.
I hope he didn't give you stage fright.
He would, but he's so hilarious.
Man, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for doing this. I can't wait to hear it. I really appreciate it, and I love your show.
Thank you. Continued success.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Just didn't work.
That's a wrap for another episode of Write You a Song. We are a production of Bonneville Communications International. This podcast is produced at KNCI Radio in Sacramento, California. I'm your host, Tom Maley. If you have questions, comments, or you have a guest idea, just hit me up on Twitter. I'm at KNCI Tom, at KNCI Tom. And next month, a young lady out of Canada who is the epitome of hard work paying off. Her debut album debuted at number one. She recently notched her first number one single. It's a duet with Brantley Gilbert called What Happens in a Small Town.
Oh, you said this goodbye was the last. I guess I could leave. I could run from the past and from us and from you. But this is where I belong. This is my
And she can not only sing, she shreds on a guitar, and she's a hell of a songwriter. Lindsay L. Next time on Write You a Song.
I still miss-